This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hello and welcome to this week's 45th podcast. Robbie is out this week, but we have some special guests for you. But for this week's show, well, last week I had prepared some topics to cover that seemed interesting at the time, like about how the HHS spokesman, Michael Caputo, had something of a, I don't know what we'll call it, a mental break on Facebook Live and led to him going on medical leave. And also about Andrei Derkach, who is the pro-Russia Ukrainian official behind the disinfo campaign targeting Biden and who has been working with Giuliani for like best part of the last year or so. Yeah, all of that seemed interesting at the time and probably still is. But unfortunately, the political world, or just the world in general, changed with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. After 27 years in the court, she passed away from pancreatic cancer. With an election just around the corner. And she apparently just had to show up Scalia in terms of making things dramatic. But this week we have two special guests. The first is Hannah McCarthy. She is the co-host of Civics 101 from New Hampshire Public Radio. And she's the co-author of A User's Guide to Democracy, How America Works. She has worked in journalism for 7 years as a print and radio reporter for various organizations, including the Vineyard Gazette, New York Magazine, and WNYC. And of course, most importantly, she's also the entire audio production team behind the 45th podcast.
Most importantly.
For the very first time, welcome to the other side of the show.
Thank you, Susan. I am thrilled to be here. It's totally bizarre.
You've been here invisibly for the past 4 years.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes. But I'm glad to have you on, along with your co-author, Nick Capodici, who is also the co-host of Civics 101. And also from New Hampshire Public Radio and the co-author of A User's Guide to Democracy. And before coming to NHPR, Nick worked in the education department of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. And Nick, I have one question from you to get started.
Yeah, go right ahead.
What is up with your Skype handle?
Oh, that's really, really shameful, isn't it? I think I joined Skype way early. I was one of those people who like got Gmail through an invitation back in the day.
You're kidding me.
And for some, you know, yeah, absolutely. And for some reason, I think I accepted a very early trial version of Skype in the 1990s. So yeah, I have a ridiculous Skype handle. I can't.
Do you even
that.
Know your own handle?
Yeah, I don't. I use it so rarely. Like, I forgot it was that. And then every time it happens, it's just shameful.
But it's like a hardcore really cool. Password. It's like 20 characters of random numbers and letters.
I emailed Skype to ask if I could change it, and they said absolutely not. Like, this is how it goes.
Yeah. Well, we've got it working now. So, how about y'all tell me a bit about your new book, The User's Guide to Democracy?
Yeah.
And is there a musical version planned for the future?
Oh, Susan, don't give Nick the idea.
I mean, that's how it's done, right?
Yeah. First you do the basics, and then you get the musical, and then you get Lin-Manuel on. That would be tremendous. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. I used to be such a huge fan of 1776, sort of the lesser known American history musical, until Hamilton came and just blew it out of the water. So.
Well, I was just thinking of a Bill on Capitol Hill.
Oh, well, that song needs to be updated in a big way, Susan.
Yeah, for real.
Now's your chance.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
kind of how this whole thing started. So obviously the book is quite similar in scope to what we do every day for our jobs, which is research and interview people about and then talk about how the government works, right? And that all started in part because after the 2016 election, everyone was writing in to our station and just asking in various ways, like, can the president do that? And also just like, what does the Secretary of Defense actually do? And what does the judiciary actually do? So a producer was like, we need a Schoolhouse Rock for adults. So we did that for years at the station. And then last year, we were approached by an agent who was like, have you guys ever considered basically a user's guide to democracy? Because these questions still exist. A lot of people have no idea still how a lot of this stuff works, how democracy works, how the government works. And the idea was basically to create like a democracy for dummies and make it as approachable as possible. People shouldn't be ashamed that they don't know this stuff, but we also feel that it's really important for the health of democracy for as many people to understand how it works as possible.
Yeah. As an attorney, I know I'm guilty of this, but in law school, going through that, I remember, if not the exact things that caused me to think that, but it's just probably a whole year, 3 years really, of just, oh, wait, that's how stuff works? And then once you get through it, you're like, oh, yeah, of course that's how it works. Everyone knows that. When there's absolutely no reason most times for people not in this field, not in politics or not in that kind of law, to have known it, or and they've never gotten the kind of instruction they need to grasp this like massive behemoth of tangled bureaucracy.
I don't know if, Susan, if you're in the same boat as I am, but I frankly had a long time ago, a rather shabby civics education, sort of a generalized social studies education for 1 year in middle school. And then so when I started the job working, I initially was Hannah and I weren't the co-hosts. We had different jobs related to the show. And before my first day, I was like hunting around every bookstore looking for sort of a general book that covered everything just so I could, you know, just memorize that before my first day on the job. And that book kind of wasn't out there. The books were more niche specific. And so this was what we made. And because we have a cartoonist from The New Yorker illustrating it, it's was a, sort of a fun, light way to get into these heavy topics that I regrettably didn't have as a kid.
Yeah, I know I had a civics class, I think probably in like fifth or fourth grade even, but I cannot for the life of me remember what we did. And I don't think we did anything useful in it.
Yeah.
So what was the most surprising thing you learned just for making this book?
Ooh, so much. I think one of the...
y'all, obviously, you've had a podcast for a while now on Civics 101, so you cover a lot of these topics, but was there anything that you learned just for the book itself that was like, oh, how did I miss that before?
Yeah, it was when we were sort of doing our own research for the book, a couple things sort of jumped out to me. One of the first most shocking things I learned was just what a tiny smidgen of laws actually make it through the legislative process and get passed into bills. That it's about 3% of bills proposed make it through both chambers and end up on the president's desk. And at first, I was really grumpy about that. I was really angry that it seemed such a seemingly ineffective process. But as was sort of explained to me by other scholars and the like, that's actually considered a feature, not a bug. Because if you want a 100% streamlined system of government, you want a dictatorship where you just make things happen as quickly as possible. That's what I was shaken about, was the complete lack of legislation that is actually passed.
Yeah.
And of that 3%, like 2% is probably like renaming post offices.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd say like 2.9%.
Like the national bird.
Yeah. All right. And that's not even, and those don't even go through the traditional legislative process. Those go through a call for unanimous vote, right? And you skip all the procedural stuff and it just, you know, that post office gets named right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, it's funny because like this is the reason that we started the show, and we had done a lot having to do with the executive branch and the president in particular. But it wasn't until I was writing a section of the book that was all about presidential precedent that I realized that the answer to the question, can he do that, is yeah, the president can do whatever the president does, like wants to do. And the only check on that is people noticing what is and is not constitutional and talking about it, bringing it up, bringing it before the Supreme Court. But it was just to see how every past president up until this point has defined what executive power is, because not that much is actually enumerated in the Constitution, and to see when Congress said something about it or didn't, and how that defined what the powers of the president are, was really, you know, I knew that in sort of a vague sense, but it wasn't until I actually like wrote down this timeline of precedents that I realized exactly how powerful the actions of any one president are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to sort of to add on to that, Hannah wrote the chapter on executive powers, and it's one of my favorites in the book because it's so nebulous, and yet, you know, you pin it down. Some like comfort to people out there who are perhaps frustrated with the current administration and sort of the amount of power that the president has. Someone once said to us that the easier it is for a president to take an executive action of some kind or another, be that like having a tweet be technically an executive order, the easier it is for that presidential power to happen, the easier it is for a future administration to unwind that power, to sort of dial it back. Because if you go through the traditional legislative process, you went through this whole rigmarole, this whole kit and caboodle, that is a lot harder to undo than a much simpler executive order, like a tweet that's not even published in the National Register.
And one of the blurrings that's happened in American political life for the past few decades, that's now getting sort of unblurred, is the distinction between how things have always been done and how they actually have to be done. And they've been effectively synonymous for many areas, for many, many years now. Yeah. But I don't think that's a safe assumption for quite a lot of those sort of assumed rules going forward. Because a lot of what we do is how it's always been done, yes, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have to be that way. It's just been that way. And that is now changing.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, not to get too, not to, you know, go against Nick's optimism there, but like the you know, past administration is proof positive of that. We had to, we did a sort of like presidential firsts, and it was, we came to basically these things that presidents did first in the administration. And we got to Trump and we were like, we can't, there are just so many. We just can't put them all down. I think we just wrote, doesn't have a pet. First yeah. president to not have a pet. Yeah.
Since Polk. Yeah. Since JFK.
Oh, Polk didn't have a pet, huh?
Yeah. I was shocked to find out.
Polk didn't have a pet ever.
No, Polk never had a pet.
I had no idea.
Well, one president had silkworms. We managed to sneak that in there.
So weird.
Yeah.
One had a hyena, which is badass.
Who had a hyena?
Oh, yeah. Who was that?
I think it was like Eisenhower.
Wow.
His name Jack or something. I'm super jealous.
Well, I'm glad you appreciate that too, Susan, because, you know, you got to have your like sort of sweet treats with the hard medicine, right? You have to like have a chapter on the parrot that cursed during Jackson's funeral, yeah. you know, to sort of to deal with executive privilege. So, yeah, we like that stuff too.
Yeah. Being in debt sucks. Credit cards, student loans, mortgages. Doesn't matter what kind, being in debt just flat out sucks. But there is a way now to defeat your debt, thanks to Bills.com. So if you're losing sleep over maxed out credit cards or stressed out thinking about your mortgage payments or student loans, Bills.com can help you take back control of your life. The first step to lowering your monthly payments and becoming debt-free is to get a free debt assessment. It only takes a few minutes and could save you hundreds or even thousands of dollars each month. From debt settlement to personal loan consolidation to student loan or mortgage refinancing, Bills.com has you covered. They are part of the Freedom Financial Network, which has been in business since 2002 and settled over $10 billion in debt. So take the first step to defeating your debt. Get your free debt assessment today. Go to bills.com/45th. That's bills.com/45th. bills.com/45th. So we are now facing, I don't want to sound hyperbolic, but I think we're facing a sea change in how American governments work. And I don't think the change itself is a bad thing. I think probably the scale is even makes even me uncomfortable with what's happening now. But I mean, just as an example, theoretically, in our Constitution, it could have played out entirely different in terms of how power is balanced between the branches. Because if they'd want to, and if they'd managed to pull it off, and if history had gone that way, we could have a system, theoretically, where every 4 years, the U.S. population goes out and votes for a president, and then the House immediately impeaches that person and the vice president, Senate agrees to that, and whoever the House made the speaker is now the leader of the free world, which would be constitutional. That is a theoretical mechanism that could play out under our current system. It's never happened that way. It's never been that way in practice, but it's something that could have been had we gone that route.
That's fascinating. We think a lot about how vague and nebulous the Constitution is and so many things that run everything to deal with our lives. So playing out the possibilities of what could happen if you throw away tradition, respect, and ceremonious form of duty, like what's going to happen next if that's just all off the table. Like I think today, I believe it was Chuck Schumer said, nothing is on the table. Nothing is off the table, right? That's a pretty
powerful
statement.
There's no table.
There's no table. There is no, the table is a lie. Yeah. So I actually appreciate that sort of thinking through possibilities of what could be under our, frankly, sometimes nebulous governing document, the supreme law of the land.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think too about the Electoral College and the fact that the Supreme Court recently ruled that it is constitutional for a state to basically punish a faithless elector, which, you know, has the effect of, I think you could argue, undoing the whole point of the Electoral College, which is to have a barrier between the masses and the election of the executive. That also speaks to sort of like the fragility of even those things that are constitutionally mandated, so long as the Supreme Court interprets that in a different way. And then that's just the new rule.
And of course, Trump today was trying to upend another presumably settled constitutional question for the Apportionment Clause. And in his quest to essentially concentrate power among a typical GOP voting bloc, is seeking to have the census not use the undocumented population as part of what the calculations use to assign representatives to different states, which before this, I think everyone would have agreed was not even on the table. But yeah, it's there now. Although in that case, it actually seems much more in conflict with the black letter law of the Constitution.
Right. That truly goes against what's written down there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not even like the there's so much gray and so much fudge zone in the Constitution. And there are these few bright line points where it's like, actually, for this random one thing, we're going to say this has to be this way.
Yeah.
And yet, even that now, we're like, okay, well, everything can be interpreted, especially when 6-3.
on the other contrast, I mean, I wrote the part on the Electoral College, and it's one of my favorite things to think about. I'm quite fascinated with the workaround the popular vote movement is using to it, which is, I think, pretty fascinating. And this is something that Hannah and I...
And it's close.
It's really close. It's like 192 electoral votes out of 270, but a lot...
Can you explain what that is?
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you. That's my job. I usually should be the one to say, let's slow this down and explain this. You just have to know it. Is if you don't know it, you'll know it now. The number of electoral votes your state gets is the number of representatives you send to Congress. So if, you know, here in New Hampshire, we have two state reps plus our two senators, we have four electoral votes. And the number of people you send to Congress is determinant on how many congressional districts you have, which is based on your population, right? Actually, let me look this up real fast because it's a good stat. Hold
on. Also, while you're doing that, Nick, Susan, it was Roosevelt. Yeah. Of course it was. It was Teddy Roosevelt who had the hyena.
How did I get that wrong? Of course it was.
He had everything.
Yeah.
That guy had so many things. So California has 55 electoral votes because it's got 55 districts, and it has a bigger population than 22 states combined, who have 96 electoral votes. So an electoral vote in a state like New Mexico or Wyoming has a staggering amount of more power than it does from the state of California. So the apportionment process is based on the census. How many electoral votes you get is based on the census. The census determines everything in our country. So if the president says that unauthorized Americans are not to be counted in terms of apportionment, that will change everything. That will change the amount of electoral votes California gets, big states like California, Texas, and New York. I just can't imagine what the outcome would be of that. But so if we were to change the process, if we were to stop using the Electoral College and go for the popular vote, which a lot of people are in favor of, that would require a constitutional amendment, two-thirds of both houses, and three-fourths of all states. So all these wonderful little...
Which they'll never agree to.
Yeah, exactly. They would never. They would never give up their extraordinary electoral power. It's not going to happen. So the only way that there's a workaround is the popular vote movement, which is to have the state pass a law on the state level that you award all of your electors to the candidate who won the popular vote for the nation. Because the idea that we have to send all our electors to vote for the candidate who won the plurality of your state, that's not in the Constitution. That's just something all the states do, with two exceptions of Maine and Nebraska. So if enough states agree to do this, to vow to send all their electoral votes to whomever won the national popular vote, and that number of states who does that has an electoral power that is equal to 270, they have an effect demolish the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment. And yeah, like you said, lots of states have signed on, and we're up to about 192 at my last count. And a lot of other states have it on ready for legislation. So if you're someone who doesn't like the Electoral College and you're in favor of a popular vote and you don't go vote on Election Day because you don't care about the two candidates for president, voting the people in who determine how your state allots electoral votes is also important. So don't give that up.
Yeah. So before we get on to the big procedural news of the day involving how Supreme Court's going forward, a quick update on our COVID numbers. As of today, we hit 200,000 Americans have now died. Official deaths, the actual total based on excess mortality over the past 9 months now, what is it? Six, 7 months, however many months, is much higher than that. And we're going to have more Americans die this year than have ever died in a year before. But looking back to March, at towards the start of this all, at a point when only 2,300-ish people had died, here is what Trump had to say about what a successful COVID response would look like in the U.S.
Because you're talking about a potential of up to 2.2 million, and some people said it could even be higher than that. So you're talking about 2.2 million deaths, 2.2 million people from this. And so if we could hold that down, as we're saying, to 100,000, it's a horrible number, maybe even less, but to 100,000. So we have between 100 and 200,000. We all together have done a very good job, but 2.2 million deaths and maybe even beyond that, I'm feeling very good about what we did last week.
So we have now exceeded even the White House's own self-established benchmark of success, the one that Trump said they'd be far, far below, you know, even the 100,000 number. And what is the White House's response to meeting this unfortunate mark?
As you know, the country has hit 200,000 deaths from the coronavirus. What do you say to Americans who are outraged over this and blame this administration for so many lives lost in this country?
Well, as you've heard several doctors in the task force note from this podium, we were looking at the prospect of 2 million people potentially perishing from the coronavirus in this country. We grieve when even one life is lost, but the fact that we have no, the fact that we have come nowhere near that number is a testament to this president taking immediate action to shutting down travel from China when the other party, Democrats, were saying that was xenophobic, for shutting down travel for Europe, for developing landmark therapeutics that are working like remdesivir.
Predictably, they are simply not acknowledging it. And personally, what struck me hearing McEnany talk about this is that line that she and Trump and so much of the GOP have used again and again about how one death is too many. And they have consistently used this rhetoric to avoid acknowledging or grappling with the mass casualties that we've now experienced, or the sheer number that is going up day by day. I mean, I feel like we're going to be in a world where we're going to have someone asking the White House, like, Kaylee, what's the White House's response to 2.2 Americans dying? And her response will be, our response is one death is too many. Because their messaging at this point is not changing. No matter how many die, we have not seen a shift in their messaging strategy. And effectively for the White House, the pandemic is over. Their response to it is over. And they hope Americans will act the same way. So nothing good on that front. There is no there's no real hope that we're going to stay close to that 200,000 number where we're at now. And God forbid we hit the 400,000 number that's now being predicted. So, yeah, everyone stay at home, wear a mask, do what you can. As for the major news of RBG dying, I feel it's necessary to note that this entire situation is in some part a result of Ginsburg's poor choices in 2013. Not to speak ill of the dead, but Ginsburg was human and she had failings. And to me, her most severe one was her hubris in refusing to resign when the Democrats had held the Senate in 2013 and when a successor could have been appointed, as when Kennedy retired earlier, 2 years ago, and Kavanaugh was ushered in. Ginsburg had the opportunity, and at the time she did not want to retire, and she felt that she was still able to continue, and she was. Obviously she was. She was in a place where she could work for many more years. So that's the choice she made, and that we are now living with the consequences of. However, although that decision has definitely fast-forwarded the current problem, she didn't cause it, and we would have gotten to this point eventually. So really, she was just an accelerationist. Because where we are now is that the GOP has made it clear they will not confirm any judge justice that's been nominated by a Democratic president. So one way or another, whenever another justice either resigned or died, we'd have ended up here one day. And instead, we're here now on the eve of the 2020 election, just to make it even more interesting. It's like it does have like a movie-like feel to it. There's just the timing. Like, of course this happens. Of course all of this is happening now because it just wasn't exciting enough. I don't know. But this is, do y'all get into the history of appointments of Supreme Court justices in your book and how that's typically gone?
Yeah, we talked about the, you know, the appointment process. Like, we really tried to, you know, to stick to the process. The trouble is, like we said at the beginning, you know, is that when the process has been done a certain way, certain times, and then you throw away all that tradition of form, where do you go next? We spoke of the Constitution being nebulous. The judicial branch is the most nebulous of the three constitutionally. It's like
nothing is said about it.
Yeah, it's like three quarters of a page, you know. Yeah.
It has to exist.
Right.
That's the rule. It has to exist.
It has
beyond
to exist.
Beyond that, here's some guidelines.
There has to be a chief justice, right? And they didn't have...
And he has to have a little more power than the rest,
right,
in terms of impeachment. That's about it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's actually very... You know, I always forget how lawyers are very good at explaining things to people.
It's true, yeah.
That's one of my
favorite
skills.
It's your job to make things comprehensible to the lay people.
So yeah, the first justices did so little. I mean, they just sort of knocked around in wagons and sort of settled circuit court disputes across the country and died from travel exposure. And they didn't even have an office. They were living in the basement under the Senate for a while. You know, they were sort of this knockabout group that rose to become the most powerful, you know, judicial body in the world. So.
And that was not fated at all. It is very easy to imagine the United States that took a different route where, I don't know, Marbury, the mass never happened.
Oh, can you imagine if that did, if Marbury, you know, got his commission, you know, he'd been sitting waiting for that.
If it had come
thing.
A different way, if it had gone just a slightly different way, if a slightly different composition of judges had just had different reasoning, it's possible that would have started a different pathway we never came back from.
Yeah.
One where the court did not have this amount of power.
Yeah. Well, if anybody out there is not familiar with what we're speaking about the court case Marbury versus Madison, which is strangely actually related to what we're talking about right now with our RBG, right? Because it also goes back to the Judicial Act of what year was it, Hannah?
Ooh. Good question. I've got it written.
Let me look
down.
It up. Oh, yes. So, yeah.
Shit. Also, I know this one.
I got it. You know this one?
I do. I'm blanking. Go.
Oh,
the Judiciary
1789.
Act of 1789.
Yeah. 1789. Yeah.
But, yeah, Marbury versus Madison is a tough opinion to read if you haven't used. Probably easy for you, Susan. It was tough for me. But it's the.
No, they make you read it first year when it's really hard.
Oh, really?
No. So, it's like Shoe v. Washington and Marbury v. Madison and the Hairy Hand case in your first year at law school, right? But Hawkins v. McGee, right. Anyway, enough about that.
Well, Susan, but, Nick wants to make a podcast about going to law school, so you should.
I do, about like all the useless stuff you learn and all the useful stuff you learn going to law school. But Marbury versus Madison, the opinion determined what we now call judicial review, which is that it is the job of the Supreme Court not to execute the law, but to determine what is constitutional and what is not constitutional. That's their be-all, end-all. And what I was also shocked to learn is that when it happened – when Marbury versus Madison happened, people weren't like, holy cow, and they weren't ringing bells and throwing banners in the wind. It kind of flew under the radar, and the Supreme Court didn't rule a law unconstitutional for like 40, 50 years after that.
In general, I'm a fan of judicial review. I think it's done great things for the country. I think it's a good idea. But for the current moment, what the implication is that technically, whatever the Supreme Court decides is the law in America, and they can decide whatever they want. I mean, yes, historically, we've had justices who do judgy things and act like judges on the surface most of the time and try and be all super, you know, judicial about it. But they don't have to. There's no law saying they got to do that. There's actually no law saying they got to be lawyers in the first place.
Right.
So theoretically, if you have the votes on the Supreme Court and you have six people out of nine, just, you know, just saying, who are willing to write whatever they feel like for whatever reason they want to make America be like whatever they feel like it should be, they could do it. Would they probably do it? No, we're not there. They will continue to be more judicially about it.
I do also just want to point out that, you know, there is anti-canon for a reason. There have been grand, sweeping, horrifying decisions made by the Supreme Court. And I'm not trying to be pessimistic here. I'm simply pointing out that it does happen, that these individuals are fallible and have motivations outside of, you know, pure, cool-headed law. And there have had to be times throughout history where the Supreme Court has said, that was a really bad decision, or that thing that we said actually was unconstitutional. Sorry about that. And I just think it's important. It's important to recognize that fallibility, because it is not a pure entity. I mean, I'm sure anyone could know that if they used their mind to think about it. But it's just important to note. Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be so long. Like we're talking about, like Dred Scott, right? And you know, big ones like Korematsu, but like Minersville v. Gobitis and West Virginia v. Barnett, these, you know, stories of Jehovah's Witness families refusing to salute the flag in school. 1940, you had it constitutional. You had, they passed a rule saying you have to salute the flag if you're asked to at your school. And then it was only 3 years later, 1943, that they overturned it. So I think even when we think of these decisions as being for life, to your point, Hannah, yeah, anti-canon is there for a reason. Like, they can be undone as well in future courts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the big question now is, will McConnell and Republicans be able to get their new justice confirmed to replace Ginsburg? And the answer is, of course they fucking will.
You know, it's true. And it does usually, the time that it takes to confirm an appointment has grown considerably ever since we have had appointments. I mean, it used to be a few days. And then I think Kavanaugh took like 77 days or something. But all it really takes is the political will to do it, right? And there's no there's no rule that says that you can't appoint during a lame duck presidency, right? So there's a push to do that before the presidential election. We don't know what that outcome is going to be, and that is in part because politically it'll be a little queasier if Trump is not going to be the president next year, but
they'll still do it.
Yes,
they'll still do it, right? If they gotta,
they can't. I mean, absolutely, constitutionally they can. There's nothing to stop them. Yeah,
and it is annoying, of course, that there's this whole, I mean, sort of blatant hypocrisy thing going on, because of course with Garland, they made up the rule that says that you can't do appoint or nominate. You can nominate, but you can't confirm a justice in the last year of a presidential term, which was never principle or rule. It's just a naked assertion of power, which McConnell was entitled to do. And it is hypocrisy, but I almost hate the hypocrisy fights, because like no one believed them in 2016. It's not like anyone's out there being serious about it. So, but anyway, as of today, to the extent there was a question about whether or not they could do it, it was decidedly answered when Romney said that yes, he will be voting, and subtext being confirming whoever it is that is nominated by Trump. And he had this interesting quote today when he was explaining his decision.
We may have a court which has more of a conservative bent than it's had over the last few decades. But my liberal friends have over many decades gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court. And that's not written in the stars. And I know that a lot of people are saying, gosh, we don't want that change. I understand the energy associated with that perspective.
it has to be a liberal court, and it should be center right like America is. Yeah. I just want to point out that this is so disconnected from reality. Republican presidents have picked 14 of the last 18 SCOTUS seats, meanwhile have won the popular vote in one of the past seven elections. And there's not been anything to call liberal court since 1969, long before my lifetime, anyway. So Romney is just flat out wrong about this. But it's not surprising that Romney is going to vote to confirm whatever judge they pick, because that's what he's always wanted. Like, Romney is not a Trump lackey, in fairness. He's not doing this for Trump. He's doing it for himself. That's what he's always wanted. It's what he's always dreamed of achieving, like the rest of the Republican Party. So when they get the opportunity, yeah, they're going to take it. The only two who are not are Murkowski and Collins. And Murkowski, because that seems more or less to be an actual position she has, and for Collins, because she's about to get her butt kicked in Maine. But yeah, this is where McConnell has the votes, despite the fact that we have Graham saying back in 2016 and 2018 that, you know, you can hold me to it. I'm not going to vote to confirm a justice in the last year of a presidential term. Of course he's going to.
This will stand the test of the time. This is the last year of a lame duck president. And if Ted Cruz or Donald Trump get to be president, they've all asked us not to confirm or take up a selection by President Obama. So if a vacancy occurs in their last year of their first term, guess what? You will use their words against them. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination, and you could use my words against me, and you'd be absolutely right. We're setting a precedent here today, Republicans are, that in the last year, at least of a lame duck 8-year term, I would say it's going to be a 4-year term, that you're not going to fill a vacancy of the Supreme Court based on what we're doing here today. That's going to be the new rule. When y'all change the rules about appellate judges and district court judges to get your way, I thought it was a really abuse of power. And what you have done here is you've made the caucuses, the Republican and Democratic caucuses, are now not going to have to reach across the aisle when it comes to appellate judges and district court judges to get input from us, or we get input from you. So what does that mean? That we're going to pick the most hard-ass people we can find. And dare somebody in the conference to vote against that person. You're going to have the most liberal members of your caucus pushing you to pick the most liberal judges, because you don't need to have to reach across the aisle to get any of our input. And we'll do the same. So over time, the judiciary is going to be more ideologically driven, because the process in the Senate now does not require you to get outside your own party. So I'll be fighting talk radio when somebody on my side puts up a nut job, and they will. And I'll fight if I think they're truly a nut job. That's going to happen on your side, too.
You know, for those out there who don't entirely grasp why this is so absolutely crucial, essential, right? Like, why any leaning on the Supreme Court makes a difference for years to come. Of course, there is the tenure of these judges. There is no limit. They can either die, resign.
They can be impeached.
Yeah, they can be impeached. And insofar that the Supreme Court is ruling on the constitutionality of things, you know, it's not just that a case will be appealed up to the Supreme Court that starts at a lower level that perhaps has something to do with Second Amendment rights, which is a top of mind for a lot of people, as are abortion access rights. It's also that the Supreme Court can rule on the constitutionality of the president's actions, right? So to keep a Supreme Court leaning one way or another, Even if they don't have control over the House and Senate, if you've got a president of a certain party sitting, that president will be much more empowered by a court unlikely to challenge or likely to uphold his or her decisions.
And on the flip side, if it's a president who did not appoint, or not of the party that appointed most of the justices, he'll be disempowered by the Supreme Court, who can strike down any bills passed under him, and can severely curtail his powers to act, which is likely what Biden will face if he's elected. And why this matters is because the Republican entrenchment of power is their only path forward, their only method of survival at this point in terms of pure demographics. Republicans have not won. They've lost 6 of the past 7 popular votes for a reason. They demographically will not be able to hold on to power through a democratic system, which is why they are so desperate and have been so focused on judicial entrenchment to allow them to maintain power, unaccountable to democracy, essentially.
Yeah. Well, one thing that shocks me when I was thinking about what a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court could do is that is even not enough to, correct me if I'm wrong, to get a writ of certiorari, you know, approved, right? You need a 4-person majority to pick a case to bring to the Supreme Court, right? So then you could just stop everything from even getting there. It's like what happens can happen in the Senate if the Senate Majority Leader doesn't want something to come out, just kill it in committee. So this would happen with court cases, which is, to my knowledge, hasn't really ever happened, where a court just won't take any cases of a certain sort of controversial nature.
They will have the power to not hear any cases they don't want to hear. Even if they'd rule against it, they could have been forced to at least consider them. Now, that is not on the table. Now we're facing swing Justice Gorsuch. That's nightmare fuel. This is about Trump, yes, but it's not really about Trump, because these consequences will far outlive any Trump administration. And this is more about the heart of America itself outside of Trump. And you know what? He's going to pick I'm not going to count anything out now, but theoretically the pick will be someone who would be a typical Republican pick for Supreme Court. He's not going to take like Giuliani and be like, hey, he's going to be Pete Gorsuch. Although, again, I'm not going to
never
like,
know
that,
yeah,
outside bet there maybe worth playing. This is not about Trump. This predates Trump. This is a Republican method of holding on to power in the face of lost Democratic power, little d Democratic power. And the reason that it doesn't matter when RBG died is that we're going to get here eventually. Because say Hillary had won, what would have happened then? At that point, the Scalia seat was still open. And here is what McCain was saying in October of 2016.
I promise you that we will be united against any Supreme Court nominee that that Hillary Clinton, if she were president, would put up.
Yeah, so McCain was not alone. Cruz was doing it. I mean, they were all doing it. In 2016, when they thought Trump was going to lose, they were all vowing that that seat would never be filled by a Democratic president. So one way or another, we were going to end up here. And again, if Ginsburg had died 4 months from now after President Biden was sworn in, and if the Senate was still controlled by Republicans, it wouldn't be any different. I mean, well, it'd be different in that they'd not fill it as opposed to filling it with Republican. But this crisis was always on the horizon, and now we're there.
Well, I was just going to ask, isn't what you think about the possibilities that have been sort of thrown around about how to swing that sort of tight grip on power?
When I got the news that Ginsburg was dead, my first and only thought, and still my only thought, is pack the court or America ends.
Yeah, I was just going to
I don't think
that
there's
up.
Any solution now.
Right.
This is something, we talk about the fact that a Supreme Court could potentially block all sorts of actions of the executive. That was going on during FDR's New Deal legislation, which, by the way, the whole reason that we have a notion of the first 100 days of the presidency is because during his first, I want to say like 103 days, FDR pushed so much legislation through Congress that he changed the way that we think of the capacity of the president. So he's doing this with his New Deal legislation, and then the court is here and there preventing some of this legislation from going through. So he's like, okay, fine. I am just going to have a bill go through Congress, because the Constitution does not say how many members of the Supreme Court, how many justices can be sitting. Congress gets to say that. I'm going to pass a bill that says we're going to make that number 15. And it was called FDR's court stacking plan. And that can be done. I mean, that it didn't happen, by the way. I mean, so it could be, we could be looking at a Supreme Court potentially with 15 justices, which of course
100.
Sure, fine. There can be no
1,000.
Limit. Yeah.
3 million. We're all, you and I, we are all Supreme Court justices. We've read our Marbury v. Madison.
Anything can happen in America.
So long story short, the court needs to go to 11 or 13 or 15 or 17, or frankly, I don't even care, although preferably odd. or else essentially we have enshrined minority rule for the rest of time. The end. And also make DC and Puerto Rico states.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot about that. Yep.
Yes.
Expanding our states.
And that one is more in line with, like, American history. Like, we've been adding new states from the very beginning. I mean, we kind of stopped recently, but, like, that is super American. So let's keep that train going.
Or, you know, we can make just add a whole bunch of new states with what we currently have. We can cut some states into, like, 10 different states.
Yeah, as long as Congress and the state says it's okay. That's how it goes.
One of my friends has a plan of East Puerto Rico, West Puerto Rico, Central Puerto Rico, and then, like, maybe, like, a Northeast Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
I mean, D.C. has 4 quadrants, and they're basically all different anyway, so I think we have 4 D.C.s now. So, is your book end on a optimistic note, or?
Yeah, it does, because I think what all of that research and writing did, at least for me, is it. I went through this roller coaster of emotions where one day I would be like, you know what, this country is founded on remarkable principles, and as long as good people uphold them, then we're gonna be okay. And then the next day I would read about some moment in history or some. Notice some power of the president and just be like, no, we're doomed. We're totally doomed. But in the end, I ended up on that upswing of that roller coaster. And the thing is that the principles in our founding documents have the capacity for great goodness, fairness, justness. And it simply takes the American people and their representatives upholding that to continue the health of this democracy. A lot of people might say that that is not happening or not happening to their heart's content right now, but that doesn't eliminate those core principles. So I do believe, Susan, that if enough people educate themselves about this nation, if enough people vote and become invested and get involved at their local and state level of government, and, you know, it's the states that get to decide how voting actually works in your state. So if you're dissatisfied with the way that voting works, if you feel disempowered, make sure you vote or run for a seat in your state. And I think if we do that, we will preserve the republic. That's just me. I don't know, Nick, what you think, but...
I mean, I just agree with you 100%. And, you know, we try to be a nonpartisan show, and we try to make our show and our book as sort of approachable from as wide an audience as possible, and not to alienate people or make them feel stupid. Like, we never want to do that. And we often say, hey, I never learned that in civics class. And it's true. But we also get to talk to a lot of teachers in the course of our job and a lot of students. And I have nothing but hope and optimism for that generation who's currently taking civics now, because they know more than I do. They're more engaged than I am in all manners of civic life. And I think that we are leaving, the country will end up in good hands eventually. It's the Annenberg public policy. Is that what it is, Hannah? The Annenberg public policy? Yeah, they do a study every Constitution Day of, like, how well does America know basic civics? Can you name the 3 branches of government? In 2017, it was like 26% of Americans could name the 3 branches. But this year, it's like 57%. Like, we have come a long way in terms of civic understanding in the last 3 years. So,
give credit where credit's due. Thank you, Trump.
Yeah, well, that's true. He's the reason we have a radio show. I mean, I guess is just sort of, when people abuse power or just change it from precedent, you are going to ask questions. And asking questions, I think, is never a bad thing to do.
Well, that is nicely optimistic, and I will try and cling to that.
Thank you.
For now.
I appreciate that.
So where can you buy your book?
Well, you can find it anywhere online, but I say support your local bookstores and just give your local bookstore a call. Ask if they have it. Again, it's called A User's Guide to Democracy, How America Works. And I just want to just give one more shout out to our illustrator, Tom Toro, who does New Yorker cartoons. He, like, makes it, and it's funny in part because of him, and it's totally delightful. But, yeah, call up your local bookseller. Keep them in business and ask if they've got it.
And where can we find you online? Since, Hannah, I know you're now on Twitter, finally.
Susan, it's so embarrassing. I'm not active on Twitter. What is wrong with me? So I've had a Twitter handle for a long time, but I've tweeted like 40 times in my life, but it's at HMcCarthyNHPR. And maybe you'll see some stuff on there, but you can also follow us at Civics101Pod.
And Nick, where are you at?
I'm just at Capodice. It's just the last name, C-A-P-O-D-I-C-E. And also, I do most of my tweeting at Civics101Pod as well.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us today. Hannah, have fun editing this later.
Thanks, Susan. This was a blast.
Thank you, Susan. It was an absolute delight. Thank you.
And we'll be back next week for all updates on the confirmation process that will undoubtedly be going on at that time. So until then, hang in there. And yeah, 2020 is going to be a rough one. Bye, guys.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.